Mission abort. Iron Gate, Timeline 3, August 2020. The Colonel, his staff in the unit, their seniors in the Office of Special Programs, and everyone in the DHS who was aware of the Jaunt Blue program and the Black Rain timeline, assumed that Rita's aborted mission had been completed largely without consequence. They couldn't have been more wrong. Rita had been clearly seen by station mate Vance Schofield, age 56. He was a 40-year veteran of the Irontown Regional Permanent Way and its successor, the Commonwealth Eastern Regional Rails, or the CERR. A sober-sided widower and abstainer from spirits, he had challenged Rita to display her ticket of travel, at which point she had vanished into thin air. Aghast and worried that his eyes were failing him, Schofield had summoned his platform attendant, one Barnett Garrison, an Observer Corps veteran, who had also noticed Rita loitering near the end of the platform, but assumed she was merely a night shift worker taken short, and turned a discreet eye. Together they searched the platform and adjacent tracks. Returning with Schofield to the platform office, Garrison noticed an unidentified object attached to one of the window panes he had cleaned the evening before. And that's when Schofield recalled the electronic memoranda about persons vanishing in broad daylight, unidentified objects, and if you see something, say something. 10 minutes later, Schofield laboriously pushed the send button on the teletype terminal that linked his office, via telephone line, to the powerful new time-sharing mainframe in Port Richmond, which the CERR had installed to coordinate their railroad network's back-office business just 5 years ago. 16 minutes later, the Commonwealth intercomputer network was chronically congested, the modems almost permanently engaged, as messaging traffic grew by leaps and bounds. His message reached the inbox of one Inspector Alice Morgan, of the Commonwealth Transport Police. Inspector Morgan was in a morning briefing, so did not receive his email at once. But half an hour after her return to a desk full of paperwork, she began to read, and the shit hit the fan. The Commonwealth Transport Police was responsible for securing a rapidly developing infrastructure network that had gone from steam locomotives and biplanes to passenger jets and high-speed rail in just 17 years. They had been reformed and trained along modern lines in the wake of the revolution as one of the key security services of the Commonwealth Deep State. They were fully briefed on world-walking and its implications. And Alice Morgan had not risen to the rank of police inspector in a society that was in many ways still deeply conservative and unaccustomed to such newfangled ideas as women working and voting, without being something of an overachiever. News usually propagates slowly, if at all, through any bureaucracy not built on advanced information technology. Of necessity, the faster channels of communication are scarce and must be reserved for important bulletins. The Commonwealth's deep state planners were aware of this. They were also aware of their most likely adversary's infowar doctrine, even though it relied on technologies that seemed like the most bizarre over-extrapolation of current trends, and the vital need to get inside their decision loop. Inspector Morgan's subsequent on-site report, filed from Schofield's own railway network terminal using her priority key, went straight over the wire to the National Security Network, carbon copied to the force commander and to the director of the Department of Parahistorical Research, flagged as a flash alert. At 3 o'clock that afternoon, Miriam Burgesson took her seat at the head of a boardroom table to chair the resulting emergency briefing.
"Background first. What have we found, Commander?" she asked.
"Lots."
Commander Jackson looked extremely unhappy, as he should have, under the circumstances.
"I've had men combing the Iron Gate South satellite switchyard since 10 o'clock this morning. So far, they've identified 4 suspicious objects believed
to be miniature televisor cameras with attached storage devices, so-called webcams. The first was spotted by accident by the platform attendant who cleaned the office window it was adhering to the previous day. He retrieved it, and after forensics finished with it, taking fingerprints and surface samples for DNA matching, it was handed over to a DPR courier. The other three devices have been left in situ by order of the incident controller until we know what you want us to do with them. They are attached to the left upper door window pane on signal box 2, the side of one of the support pillars on the platform awning, and above the northern side door of the supervisor's office on platform 3. The switchyard is currently closed while my officers conduct a fingertip search of the entire yard, including the track beds. An hour ago, they identified another suspicious object, a device concealed in a lump of timber that had been placed on a walkway between tracks 8 and 9. It's a small sealed weatherproof plastic container and it radiates magnoelectric vibrations. Jackson's terminology was archaic, a product of an education that predated the arrival of the Klan exiles and the deluge of new science and technology they'd catalyzed. So, witness sighting of a person who vanished into thin air from a normally reliable member of staff, and indirect confirmation in the shape of concealed monitoring devices. Miriam frowned. She wished she felt sufficiently at ease to relax her politician's mask and actually vent her true emotions. Scream and shout, maybe throw something at the wall. But it would send entirely the wrong message at this point. Deep breathing time. Ken, analysis? What do your people say? Anything else? Ken McInnes, her deputy director in charge of operational analysis, shook his head. We're still putting it together. There's been a marked uptick in UFO sightings in Pennsylvania in general over the past month, described variously as giant hornets or tiny airplanes. Air Defense Command confirms some anomalous sightings both from the Observer Corps and radar, but the objects were flying low and slow and nobody managed to get a lock. They scrambled interceptors for two of the sightings, but there was nothing there when the jets arrived. I would speculate, let me caution that this is uncorroborated guesswork, that the adversary might be using very small drones to conduct localized probes. If they pop into our airspace less than 1,000 feet up, spend most of their time barely above treetop height, and hang around for less than 15 minutes, we'll have the devil's own job spotting them. On the upside, there's no sign of activity anywhere else. Whatever's going on, it's highly local. We haven't seen any sign of UFOs over the Pacific Northwest or the Andes, for example. They're focusing on Iron Gate and Philadelphia. So I think what we may be seeing is airborne activity in support of a ground-based clandestine insertion. Worse and worse. Miriam glanced sideways at the woman in the wheelchair. Any thoughts? Where did they get the World Walker? Olga looked haggard. She had a bad tendency to insist on working even when she was too ill to do so productively. But as usual, she asked the right question. Do we have a defector? Or is this something else? She gave Miriam a penetrating stare. Defectors. Miriam rolled her pen between index finger and thumb. Fuck. She looked up. Action this day. Immediate roll call of all world-walking personnel by order of the commissioner in charge, MITI. Make it so. She glanced at Olga again. The head of the clan's own internal security force, such as it was, shook her head doubtfully. What are the chances they unearth that bastard Greiben's database? She asked.
Database? Echoed McInnes.
Low, but not impossible. Olga raised a frail fist to cover her mouth when she coughed. She was only 40, but looked older than Miriam's early 50s, life's unfairness personified. You're aware of Greiben von Hjalmar's position as the clan's in-house doctor back in the day? McInnes nodded. Von Hjalmar had thrown in his lot with the wrong side during the confused and turbulent aftermath of the revolution. Not the royalists, but the quasi-Stalinists. He'd paid with his life. He ran a fertility clinic in the United States to help childless couples conceive. Heads around the table nodded, uncertainly. The Commonwealth's demographic profile and medical technology was such that it still had a surplus of orphanages. He was compiling a database of children conceived via this clinic, using seed harvested from world walkers. The plan was to pay the resulting women at adulthood to act as host mothers, producing a crop of active world walkers a generation down the line. Heads were shaking, and a low undercurrent of whispering started. "Silence," snapped Miriam. "Leave the commentary for later. Let her continue." "Your mother assassinated the clinic's director and stole what she thought was the entire database of latent carriers." Miriam nodded. "Iris had been an unholy terror, even in a wheelchair. But her grasp of modern technology was sadly deficient."
"You think she left something?"
Miriam momentarily forgot her own instruction. "Don't know. Insufficient data." Olga's cheek twitched. "The first generation carriers would be aged between 17 and 22 at this point, but they'd be carriers, not world walkers themselves."
"But you're thinking, if there's some way to activate the ability, the Americans have had more than 15 years to work on it?"
Miriam looked round the table. No whispering, just 12 pairs of eyes drilling into her as if her blood contained answers to their every nightmare question.
"I don't know," she said.
She felt like screaming, "Do you think I'm clairvoyant or something?" But she didn't. She knew what would happen. Half of them probably did think she was clairvoyant. The clan refugees, since that tentative start in the freezing cold prison camp in the winter of 2003 to 2004, had turbocharged the embryonic Commonwealth with imported alien ideas. The Commonwealth had made as much technological progress in 17 years as Timeline 2 had in 3 decades. But it had unfortunate side effects. Everyone looked at her as if she were some kind of Albert Einstein-Marie Curie hybrid. They expected her to have all the answers, all of the time.
"Let me repeat that. I don't know. But I think we should bear it in mind as a worst case. The United States knows about us. They've been sending drones, and we've shot down a few. If they've got actual world walkers, then what we're seeing is an early attempt at clandestine insertion, possibly supported by tactical drones. It's an information-gathering exercise, and our friend the station mate accidentally disrupted it." She shrugged. "Recommendations?" Olga spoke up. "Keep looking for UFO sightings. Blanket those areas with watchers. That would be Iron Gate and Philadelphia, yes? Brief the regular beat police. Also, perhaps ask the Commonwealth Guard to put boots on the ground. And move close-range air defense units into position. A spy scare in the local newspapers would prime the locals. Remember to brief the cops, not to use lethal force. Do they have tasers yet?" Electric stun guns copied from the American products were a new development. Commander Jackson shook his head.
"They're available, but not issued yet. Men don't like them. The battery packs are heavy, and they're no use against real guns."
Miriam checked him. "Clandestine world walkers won't stick around to get into a gunfight. They'll just leave. I want them taken alive for questioning, if at all possible. Shooting them may not stop them from world walking, but if you tase them and get them blindfolded, they won't be able to escape."
Jackson nodded, unhappily.
"Tasers, blindfolds. And you want everyone briefed? It's going to cause chaos."
"Not necessarily." Olga looked thoughtful. "It is a first contact scenario. Miriam, I believe you have some experience in this regard?" Perhaps you could explain to the commander here how a world worker goes about making first contact with a new timeline. Then he can focus his planning accordingly. Philadelphia, Timeline 2, August 2020. It was, Rita supposed, a sign of how urgent the operation was becoming that the chaos today was constrained. Rubbernecking was discouraged, and the guards were enforcing the guest list as sternly as bouncers at a Hollywood red carpet event. But not everything was running so smoothly. "It makes me look like a hippie," Rita complained to Gladys Jensen, the wardrobe supervisor. "Are you sure it's meant to be this color in daylight?"
"That's what the analysts told me."
Gladys looked apologetic.
"That camera of yours is okay. It captured a decent spectrum from the lights, so we were able to calibrate a proper color balance and white point and extract useful color information from the people you photographed. This is what they wear in daylight. The pattern block is guesswork, and we don't know what fiber mix they use, but I'm betting on cotton and wool. Natural all the way."
Rita looked at herself in the mirror. The dark gray smock hung to her ankles, and the accompanying blouse and jacket made her look like an extra out of a historical movie. Dr. Zhivago, maybe. "This really isn't my style."
"Tough. You were shooting at night from cover, and the crowding on the platform obscured the detailing. Those baggy pant and tunic outfits are risky, unless you can bring me some more shots. If you find a dressmaker's shop, how about scanning some fashion plates or patterns for me? And get a bunch of daytime candid camera shots around the station, so next time you look more like a respectable citizen and less like you push a broom in a factory."
"Boots." Rita sat down.
"That's less of a problem. I'm guessing they use leather and go for durability. I'm assuming they lace up. I didn't see any obvious zip fasteners in your camera roll. So we got you a pair of regular boots with half-inch heels. Again, if you pass a cobbler or shoe shop, grab some images."
Gladys offered her a cardboard box. Rita opened it and gave black calf-high boots a grudging nod.
"Okay, what about headgear?"
"This." Gladys held out a hat with a floppy brim. "Off the shelf. It's a close enough match for one of the subjects. If it attracts the wrong kind of attention, ditch it, but only if you're sure it's not going to get found. None of these items will stand up to examination. The fabric's going to be all wrong, right down to the fiber lengths, never mind the lack of labels and detail work. Any halfway competent detective who gets their hands on you will figure out you're a clandestine agent in 30 seconds flat just from your clothing. That's why we need coins to clone, and real local clothes, before we can begin to build out a reliable agent insertion protocol."
"Oh, great," Rita sighed. "Gear bag, purse?"
"We're still working on them," Gladys admitted. "The shift workers you shot mostly weren't carrying any. They probably eat at a diner in the factory. One of the women had something big, like carpet bag big, but we didn't get a good enough shot. Again, if you pass luggage shops or a department store, scans would be good."
"Scans?" Rita sighed.
"With what? I mean, if I don't have a bag, what am I meant to carry a camera in?"
"Check out the coat. See that seam? There's a concealed pocket in there. And more pockets. Here and here."
Gladys grinned.
"It's a genuine old-school spy coat. If you invert it, it's fawn. This way out, it's charcoal."
"Ah." Rita sat up. "So, I have a mapper."
Props had taken her through the basics of the mil-spec inertial navigation system earlier in the afternoon.
"What about a camera?"
"You'll be using this."
Gladys pulled out a compact slab of blackened aluminum. It sported a touchscreen on the back, and on the front, a shuttered synthetic sapphire lens turret beneath a rough patch where the rune Canon had been ground away.
"It's a light-field camera.
saves to a memory card if there's no phone signal. The smarts are all in the adaptive optics and the light field sensor. It's got a times 50 zoom and infinite focal depth.
Oh, great.
Rita turned it over in her hands.
Smile.
Hey, no,
Gladys protested before Rita could push the shutter button.
No way. That's going over to Black Rain. You better keep it sterile.
Okay. Rita put it down. How am I meant to practice?
There's a manual.
Gladys passed her a slim booklet, its cover labeled Getting Started in 16 languages.
Memorize it or something. Or put the snapper on automatic and leave it to make all the decisions. It's probably smarter than you and I put together.
Great. So is there anything more?
I don't think so.
Gladys looked her up and down.
If you get a chance to find out what they use for underwear, that would be very useful. And I want to know about men's fashion, too.
Rita gave her a look.
But this is the best we can do for now. You should be all right at a distance. Just remember, it probably won't stand up to close inspection.
Thanks for all the hard work. Rita eased her trainers off and began to work her way into the boots.
I mean that.
Sorry I can't wait around, though. I've got to go and see Ivan next. Last time he was threatening to break out skin whitening creams, and God knows what he's going to want to do to my hair.
New London, Timeline 3, August 2020. Adrian Holmes, secretary to the Central Commission of the Inner Party, ran his department from a small windowless room deep in the former Imperial Palace. In place of a window, his office wall had a painting, a classic by George Stubbs, part of the Commonwealth State Art Collection. Frederick, Prince of Wales, arrives in Boston. A 52-year-old king-to-be, in white wig, hose, and red coat, not yet the ermine and crown and scepter of the emperor in exile, standing on a pier, graciously accepting the welcome of the city fathers. In the background, lurking, the engineer of the royal settlement and first prime minister of the new empire, Baronet Benjamin Franklin, in Holmes's opinion, a beacon and an object of emulation. Holmes was not happy. Neither, for that matter, were the two men standing before his desk.
"Stop, please, and rephrase your report,"
Holmes said, staring at the older, shorter one of the two, silver-streaked gray hair combed back around his shining pate, a deeply lined face, and a smashed nose, souvenirs of a more exciting youth than his sober minister's tailcoat now suggested.
"As succinctly as possible, if you will."
The younger man, skinny and bearing an air of perpetual worried puzzlement, sighed quietly and shifted from foot to foot, his hands clutched behind his back. He glanced at his elder, then back to the secretary, who was younger than either.
"The Burgessons are active," said the older man. "The wife was summoned to an emergency meeting of a cross-departmental security committee the day before yesterday. Other attendees included Commonwealth Guard and Transport Police officials. Her director of espionage at the DPR then took off for Philadelphia with some hand-picked officers, wiring orders ahead that stirred up the local constabulary and guard barracks like hornets' nests. Something to do with alien spies of the world-walking variety. Meanwhile, Mr. Burgesson is holding meetings with every commissioner who'll give him the time of day, promising them a chicken in every pot and a pie on every plate."
"And the other thing?"
Holmes turned his gaze on the younger man. He dry swallowed.
"My correspondent within the ministry confirms the rumour we caught wind of back in April. They are pursuing some scheme in great secrecy, on which account they have detached a Major Julius Hjorth of the DPR, a world walker, for special duty. The new information is that they're sending him to Berlin, in great secrecy. The correspondent in question has not yet been able to tell me what is happening,
only that the assistant director of security at the Department of Parahistorical Research is managing it directly, on Mrs. Burgesson's orders, and that Major Hewlth is a relative of hers. He went underground a few months ago, but we know nothing about what he's been doing, except that they shipped him down to Maracaibo for some sort of special training.
Lovely.
Holmes looked away, resting his eyes on the painting.
The rats are scrambling.
He looked squarely at the younger fellow.
Keith, I want to know more about this operation in Berlin.
Keith was not so young, merely in his early 30s, and not so puzzled and worried, unless it was the perpetual puzzlement and worry of the espionage obsessed, which was indeed the main purpose in life of Keith Pierrepoint, Holmes's rat-catcher-in-chief.
It's out of their usual territory. I am distressed. Are you following the news from the enemy court?
The royal betrothal, sir? Pierrepoint raised an eyebrow. I gather the nuptials are to be delayed until the princess turns 18. Rather a late ripening, if you ask me.
Holmes shook his head. Big picture, man, follow the big picture.
His tone of mild disappointment made Pierrepoint nervous, with good reason.
She is going to finishing school, Pierrepoint. Can you guess where?
Pierrepoint's mouth made an O. He closed it silently and nodded.
It falls somewhat outside my remit, sir, but I take your point. Berlin, Harry, Holmes said, looking now at the older man. Commissioner Burgesson has suddenly developed an appetite for meddling in foreign affairs, just as we are called upon to confront the first man's unfortunate decline. I do not believe this is a coincidence. I want Keith to find out more about Mrs. Burgesson's plans for the pretender's daughter. I'm afraid we shall find evidence of treason. If not, look harder.
His cheeks tensed in an expression that might have been mistaken for a smile by an excessively naive onlooker.
As for her plan, whatever it is, I trust Keith to disrupt it as embarrassingly as possible. If nothing else, she needs to learn to stick to her brief. I'm sure there are channels by which the French might accidentally learn of the presence of an agent in Berlin. But you, Harry, have the bigger job. I'm sure you can read my mind.
Harrison Baker, chief of staff to the party secretary, nodded lugubriously.
Leverage. Exactly.
Now Holmes smiled.
A live boy or a dead girl in the Minister of Sanctimony's bed should be sufficient. Let Mr. Burgesson bluster his way out of that, or something of equivalent magnitude. Something to sow distrust between the two of them. Something sufficient that any judge would grant a divorce on the spot, or some other soot to spill across his spotless reputation. At a minimum, find enough to make his faction question his discretion and his fitness to lead in the months ahead.
Baker nodded again.
I am unaware of any singular vices attached to the man, sir, but I'm sure something can be arranged. Not certain it'll split him from her. They've been thick as thieves since before I met them, but it ought to be possible to isolate him otherwise. Good man.
Holmes's smile faded.
You've both got work to do. Don't let me keep you from it.
And a good day to you, sir, murmured Pierrepoint as he accepted his dismissal and turned to leave. He might as well not have bothered. The secretary's nose was already buried in the next of his briefings. Pierrepoint took a deep breath and released it as he and Baker left the claustrophobic inner study behind, passing the vigilant eyes of the outer office staff. An unaccountable sense of relief seized him. Unaccountable, for he knew how little it meant to be out from under the direct gaze of the secretary. Holmes had eyes everywhere. If the Burgessons and other party commissioners were rats, scurrying about their urgent business with vibrating whiskers and beady eyes, lining their nests and tending their pups. Holmes was something cold-eyed and reptilian. A new ruler in waiting, coiled vigilantly in the cloaking shadows. And when the first man finally departed, Holmes would ensure that there were fewer rodents in the palace. Philadelphia, Timeline 2, Iron Gate, Timeline 3, August 2020. The 4:30 wake-up alarm buzzed. Rita surfaced dozily from a melatonin-assisted warm bath of dreamless sleep to find herself in a bunk bed in a compact trailer. Stumbling and red-eyed, she worked her way through morning ablutions in the cramped bathroom, then dressed in the alien hippie drag Gladys had set her up with. The camera and inertial mapper were fully charged. She stowed them carefully in her concealed pockets before opening the door. It was cold outside, with a pre-dawn chill that hinted at autumnal weather to come. Beyond the security wall, agents in windbreakers moved around, prepping the convoy of vehicles that would escort her to the insertion site.
"You look like you need this."
Patrick thrust an insulated mug of coffee into her hands. She nodded her sleepy gratitude.
"Ivan's waiting. You got about 20 minutes.
Incurably taciturn Ivan, exactly unlike anyone's stereotype of a male makeup artist, sat her down and examined her.
"Huh. Your eyes are shot."
He paused.
"Good thing they're not big on bold statements there."
He applied dull foundation powder and fill-in for the shadows, designed to make her look inconspicuous and pallid, at least by the standards of her natural skin tone.
"That crowd was pretty white bread, but we think you can probably pass for a deep suntan."
He moved around and rapidly gathered her hair, pinning it up so that the hat brim covered it and shadowed her face.
"That should do for now. Let's hope you're not noticeable. Try not to smile. Your dentition is too good."
He frowned.
"Next station."
There was a big crew cab pickup parked outside. The colonel was waiting beside it.
"Come on," he said.
She climbed into the back and found herself the unwelcome filling in a Gomez and O'Neill sandwich.
"Okay, we're just about ready," said Smith,
leaning in through the window.
"See you at the zone."
They rode in silence most of the way. Rita felt acutely uncomfortable, trying not to touch the prickly Gomez or cozy up too tight to Patrick. Nobody spoke. Eventually, she pulled out the inertial mapper and tried to follow the route on it. It nailed I-476 as accurately as a sat-nav.
"Huh," said Gomez, looking over her shoulder. "You want to put that away? Save the battery for later."
Rita blanked the backlit screen. "What are you even doing here anyway?" she asked.
"I'm guarding your sorry ass in case the clan come after you."
Gomez wouldn't meet her gaze, so she focused on the brooch the woman wore. Two superimposed gold triangles, pointing upward.
"Isn't that a Scientology symbol?" Rita wondered.
"Just do your job and we can all go home happy tonight."
"The clan isn't going to come after me."
Rita shut her eyes.
"Rita," it was Patrick, "don't go there, please."
"I am sick and tired of internal politics," she rounded on Gomez. "You've been on my case ever since we met. What is it with you? Is it my skin color or something?"
Gomez recoiled.
"You're a spoiled bitch carrying a shitload of suppressive baggage around with you, and if it was up to me, you wouldn't be cleaning the toilets. Ladies!"
Patrick was clearly annoyed.
"Not in public."
"Shit," Rita yawned, then caught herself. Gomez stared determinedly up front, to where a pair of uniforms Rita hadn't met were pointedly ignoring them.
"So much for Patrick's offer of help," she thought grimly.
"Keep a lid on it for another half hour.
Patrick gave them both a look.
Try to play nice. Do you want me to ask Eric to arbitrate?
Rita bit her lip. There had to be some other reason the colonel was keeping Gomez in the unit. Hard case cops were 10 a penny. Hard case cops with connections, maybe less so. Perhaps he wanted Gomez around because he knew she was leaking to one of the internal factions. Or perhaps he thought he needed to keep Rita on her toes and didn't realize how badly Gomez was harassing her. But whatever the reason, it was stressing her out. They traveled the rest of the way in silence. They turned off the interstate, drove through the darkened streets of South Philly, then across the expressway and into the Navy grounds near the river, and finally arrived at a parking lot close by the Office of Naval Intelligence. They weren't alone. A small gaggle of DHS crew cabs and unmarked sedans clustered together. Traffic cones connected by crime scene tape cordoned off a square on one edge. Patrick opened his door.
Showtime, he said quietly.
Site survey says the other side is pretty much fallout free.
Break a leg.
Rita nodded. She no longer felt like speaking. She was simultaneously tired and keyed up.
Let's get this over with, she thought wearily.
The colonel was waiting in the taped-off area.
You know the plan, he said quietly. Eyes open, mouth shut, freeform. Come back whenever you find yourself outside your comfort zone. Call me on this and we'll come fetch you.
He handed over a tiny dumb phone, the voice and text only variety that had a month-long standby life.
And remember the real objective.
Okay. If I'm not back in 2 minutes, expect me in 3 to 8 hours. Rita grinned, then rolled back her left sleeve, squeezed her forearm, and clicked her heels. There's no place like home, she jaunted. The parking lot vanished. She stumbled in the dark, felt damp grass underfoot. It was colder here. In her ear, the clicking of a radiation counter. Timeline 1 was still hot from the nuking of the Grunmarkt, even this far south. She raised her wrist, queued up the next trigger engram, and jaunted again. Noise assaulted her, a screech of metal on metal. She stumbled, felt hard asphalt underfoot, took a step backward and nearly tripped over a curbstone. She managed to catch her balance on a narrow strip of sidewalk. The amber washout glare of streetlights cast multiple shadows in all directions. There was a windowless building behind her, concrete or stone. Steel rails gleamed as a streetcar rumbled and swayed toward the spot where she'd been. The narrow strip of paving she'd found was barely wide enough to stand on, and as the streetcar passed, she saw more tracks beyond it, and heard the snap and crackle of overhead wires. If it isn't one train station, it's another, she thought, dismayed, then kicked herself mentally. No, it's a streetcar depot. The colonel said they're big on public transport. I'm standing in the middle of the tracks. She looked round at the wall. It vanished into the near distance, and high overhead there was a vaulting arch of metal girders supporting a dark ceiling. The streetcar was slowing. Across 4 or 5 tracks, she saw a low platform, notice boards that might have been timetables, and boxy station furniture that might have been ticket machines. Did the driver see me? She wondered. She'd nearly jaunted in front of the tram. I could have been run over, she thought with a sick feeling. There was no platform in this part of the station, and no way out that didn't involve crossing several tracks. Swallowing, she glanced at her wrist and tried to jaunt again. She felt a silvery flash of pain, but nothing happened. Ow! She squeaked aloud, seeing the station still around her. She stepped sideways and tried again. This time it worked. She was back in the rainy nighttime forest. She closed her eyes, trying to remember how far away the station wall was. Took another step sideways, holding out her right arm to avoid obstacles. Stepped sideways once more. There was no tree in this direction. Now she looked at her wrist, squeezed to light up tired phosphors. Come on, she murmured, focusing again. She dropped almost a foot to the ground, landing hard. This time the wall was to her left. She stood on a broad sidewalk. Turning, she saw buildings opposite, in a variety of unfamiliar styles. It was dizzyingly, achingly close to familiar. Street markings that were somehow wrong. Signposts bearing old-fashioned traffic directions, but in a style nothing like the road signs she had grown up seeing. It was dark, the street lighting dim, and the walls stained black with old soot. Half the storefronts were shuttered with metal grills. The brick and stone of the buildings gave them a curious air of permanence, and they hunched close together.
"Okay, I'm round the back of the downtown station," she whispered into the tiny mic in her lapel.
She pulled out the inertial mapper and tapped a waypoint.
"Let's see if I can find the front."
The station was in some ways comfortingly familiar, neoclassical in style, with the same stone columns and arches as many another 19th century railway station. The surrounding buildings were less reassuring, though. There were few people about, although she spotted a man pushing a wheelbarrow slowly along a sidewalk, using long-handled tongs to pick detritus from the pavement. Mouse-like, she scurried past behind his back. In front of the station there was a wide-open traffic circle, with many roads radiating away from it, like pictures she'd seen of Grand Army Plaza in Brooklyn. A huge plinth dominated the island in the middle, supporting a statue of a man on a horse. The color of the streetlights was somehow wrong, too orange for her eyes. They flickered slightly, and as she watched, one of them dimmed abruptly to a sullen neon red, then faded to dark. There were one or two pedestrians out, bundled in long coats against the morning chill. Rita walked up to the front of the station and found metal gates drawn shut. A rattle of chains drew her eyes toward a uniformed man in an odd-shaped hat, the brim pinned up on either side. He was unfastening the gate at the far end, fumbling with a padlock.
"Opening time," she said quietly. "They're just opening the public entrance now."
She checked her wrist.
0609.
They're not early risers in the city. She turned and looked across the circle. Picking a street at random, three lanes wide in either direction with broad sidewalks and 4 to 6 story buildings on either side, she jaywalked across as fast as she could go without running. On the other side, she found herself looking into the darkened windows of storefronts. For some reason, they didn't seem to go in for big expanses of plate glass. The windows consisted of panes a couple of feet wide, set in wooden or metal frames. Some things were constants, though. Proprietors' names were proudly emblazoned across doorways and on signboards hanging in front. Headless dressmakers' dummies, swathed in odd-looking outfits, loomed in the twilight.
"Downtown shopping district, I think," she whispered.
Rita heard the unmistakable sound of a truck in the distance and spooked. The recessed vestibule of a shop offered her cover, gilt lettering on the door proclaiming it to be Barrow's Millinery. She stepped backward. The engine note was growing louder rapidly. Then the truck turned the corner. All she caught was a confused glimpse of a long hood and dark windows behind bright headlights. It pulled over on the far left side of the street. Doors opened. Male voices called. Several men got out. Doors slammed, and the truck began to move again. She heard boots on the sidewalk, the men talking conversationally as they walked along the far side of the road. Rita turned her face toward the shop's interior.
"Let's try and look as if I belong here," she decided. "They're probably just clerks arriving to open up shop."
Something metal cold shoved up hard against the back of her neck.
"Dunna move,"
said the man behind her. His throat was hoarse, his voice deep.
"I said dunna move, woman. Dunna speak. Dunna even breathe."
Rita froze from the belly out. She'd been so focused on the carload on the far side of the street that she'd never even heard his approach. Her left arm hung uselessly by her side. Her head-up display could flash a trigger engram if she asked, but the finger wrapped around the trigger of the gun at her head would be faster.
When I stop talking, I want you to slowly turn and face the wall. Hands up and brace yourself. Lean in. Then go to your knees. I am placing thee under arrest by authority of the Commonwealth Guard.